Runoff, episode number one. Runoff by Mark Coggins is a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp, says hard-boiled great James Crumley. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Subscribe to hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com. Chapter 1, The Midnight Ride of John Deere. I shouldn't have been surprised when the backhoe materialized out of the Chinatown fog, ran onto the sidewalk, and took out a column supporting the pagoda roof of the Bank of Canton. But I was. Parked under a sagging fire escape on Wentworth Street, once known as Salty Fish Alley for its vats of fish and shrimp curing in salt, I was reading a back issue of Downbeat by Penlight in the front seat of my Galaxy 500. It was close to 2 a.m., and I had been there since midnight, trying to get a lead on the thief who had been knocking off San Francisco ATMs over the last month. He'd been targeting freestanding machines in front of banks, and while it was obvious that heavy equipment entered the equation somewhere, no one had actually seen how it was being done. My motivation was a $10,000 reward the Bay Area Bankers Association had offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the suspect. Given that I'd made a total of $25 for my private investigation business since the beginning of the crime spree, and that only because I'd answered the phone in my office when someone had called with a survey on fiber supplements, I figured there were worse ways to spend my time than trying to earn the reward. What I didn't figure was getting lucky on the first night. I dropped the magazine and fumbled open the door. I ran to the mouth of the alley and then across Washington Street to the front of the bank. The fog, the slickened pavement, and the lights on the backhoe stabbing through the swirling vapor like search beams gave the scene an eerie Landing Rover on a Distant Planet sort of appearance. Big was a small word for the guy in the driver's seat. Neck bolts aside, he looked like someone the villagers should be chasing with torches and pitchforks, but was dressed like it was just another day at the construction site, right down to his work boots and hard hat. He had bulldozed the ornamental column out of the way and was busy lowering the bucket of the front loader to the place where the ATM joined its concrete pedestal. I had decided to pull stakeout duty on a whim after playing some jazz bass at a nearby club, and it suddenly occurred to me that I hadn't brought a gun or any other means of persuasion, apart from my irresistible personality. But that didn't stop me from putting my beak into it. I came up to about 5 feet of him, shined the puny pinlight in his face, and shouted, "What do you think you're doing?" Engine noise and focus on the task at hand kept him from hearing me or noticing the pinlight. He drove the blade of the bucket into the ATM and gunned the motor to put the horsepower to work. I waved my hands and shouted again to no effect, and then finally hit on the idea of chucking the pinlight at him. It bounced off his hard hat and flopped into the loader bucket. That got his attention. He snapped his gaze in my direction, and I got my first clear look at his face. It was big and red, with a lopsided goatee of coarse red whiskers encircling his mouth like bad topiary. He wore glasses with cheap black rims that were patched at the bridge with adhesive tape. He yanked his foot off the gas and twisted around in the seat to see me better. "What are you doing?" I repeated when the sound of the backhoe's exhaust had subsided. He frowned. "What's it look like I'm doing?" His voice was deep and rumbly like barrels going down a ramp. "Demolishing the building. A better question would be, what are you doing? Please stay back so you're not injured." His matter-of-fact response made me doubt myself for the slightest moment. I felt my jaw sag open as I pondered what to say. My glance strayed to the dashboard of the backhoe. There was no ignition key in the switch, and below the dash was a tangle of wires, several of which had been stripped. I gestured at the obvious hotwire job. "Leave the keys in your other frock?" He looked down at the dash involuntarily and then brought his eyes up to meet mine. A grin spread slowly across his face. "You might have something there," he said. but don't get frisky about it. He did something fancy with a hydraulic lever and tromped on the gas. The backhoe growled in response, and the loader bucket surged against the ATM with a wrenching, scraping sound. If you ever try to stop a guy in a backhoe with your bare hands, you'll soon find it's a little like trying to stop a tank with the same implements. I couldn't think of anything else to do but rush the driver's cage and try to pull him off the seat. I managed to get my foot on the stepwell and my hand on the roll cage bar when he reared back and planted a work boot square in the middle of my chest. I went sailing out into the street, where I landed in a pothole full of cold, muddy water and cocked my head on a conveniently placed manhole cover. I spent most of the next few moments groaning, rubbing my head and trying to squirm out of the water, but I discerned a brittle crunching noise over the sound of the backhoe's diesel, followed by a loud clang. Then I heard the backhoe moving away, the pitch of the motor falling and rising as the guy with the red goatee worked the transmission through the close-ratio gears. I staggered to my feet in time to see him turn the corner down Wentworth Street. The source of the clanging noise was readily apparent. The Bank of Canton's flossy automatic teller machine now rode in the backhoe's loader bucket. I stumbled after him, pulling my cell phone out of my jacket pocket as I ran. By the time I got to the mouth of the alley, the backhoe was already at the end of the block, where Wentworth dead-ended into Jackson. He turned left and disappeared from view. I tried to punch in 911 on the phone while running, but the backlight on the display kept going off before I could locate the next digit. I finally gave it up as a bad job and pulled up by the door of a brush painting studio, which was at least partially lit by a dim yellow bulb in the Chinese lantern over the entrance. A giant panda gave me a bored look through the window while I called the 911 operator and told her about the theft. She did her best to be sympathetic and helpful, but I couldn't make her understand I wasn't talking about an ATM mugging. "I realize you're upset," she said finally. "We'll get a patrol car to the scene as soon as possible. Just be sure to stay by the teller machine until they arrive." "I'm trying my damnedest," I snarled into the phone, "but it keeps moving on me." I flipped the cell phone shut and broke into a sprint, crunching over a broken liquor bottle as I rounded the corner at Jackson. The guy with the goatee was nowhere in sight. I kept pounding the pavement up Jackson, crossed the intersection with Grant, swiveling my head to check it as I went, and then turned back to see a huddled bundle lying squarely in my path. I couldn't stop, but I managed to put enough oomph in my next stride to leap over the obstacle. I landed heavily on the other side, clutching a rain spout to stop myself from reeling back.
"Watch it, boyfriend," croaked a voice behind me. "Gene Kelly, you're not."
A homeless woman with a complexion like a dried apple core levered herself out of a half-zip sleeping bag to stare at me. I'd seen mummies that looked healthier. "Sorry. Did you see a backhoe go by here a minute ago?" She slumped back onto the ground.
"Try Ross Alley. I think he turned up there."
I nodded my thanks and hurried up Jackson again to the next intersection with Ross. Some African cultures believe that evil travels in a straight line, but mischief, if that was the right way to refer to the guy with a goatee, could evidently negotiate some circuitous routes. Originally home to gambling houses and brothels in the wild Barbary Coast days, Ross Alley is a very narrow throughway that has retained enough of its character to be featured in movies like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. As I entered, I could see several places where the backhoe had scraped the walls getting by, and I could also see the machine itself at the end of the block. Goatee was at the controls, raising the loader up to the level of a dump truck, parked perpendicular to the alley. As I crept closer, I saw that there was another man sitting behind the wheel of the truck. There wasn't any doubt where the ATM was going if I didn't succeed in stopping them, but my problem was compounded. I still had no gun, and now there were two guys with heavy equipment to deal with. I cast about the alley for something to use as a weapon. The choices were limited. Flattened cardboard boxes outside the door of a fortune cookie factory, a rickety-looking bicycle chained to a gas meter, and five or six little cairns of bricks or cobblestones piled up in front of other businesses. The bricks were the obvious choice. I wondered why they were there until I remembered the recent renovation of Chinatown's Commercial Street. Commercial had been one of the last streets in San Francisco to retain its brick paving, but when it came time to replace sewer lines below the street, city officials decided they were too weak to stay and replaced them with concrete. Many Chinese residents had salvaged the old bricks and placed them in and around their businesses because they were believed to promote good feng shui. I made a silent apology to the owner of a one-chair barbershop as I scooped up a dozen fist-sized stones in front of his establishment and piled them into a makeshift carry-all fashioned out of my jacket. I crept down the remaining stretch of alley and slipped out behind the backhoe and around the dump truck to stand about 10 yards from the driver's partially open window. He had turned in his seat to watch his goatee raise the loader bucket to the level of the dump bed and had no idea I was there. Until I threw the first brick. The first one came in low, pounding the door with an incredible thud. The driver jumped like he had sat on an electric juicer and twisted back to look out the window. I wouldn't be human if I didn't admit to getting the slightest bit of satisfaction from the crazed expression on his face. Not that I took time to savor it. I had the second brick airborne before he caught sight of me, and fortunately for him, it bounded off the truck's side mirror. The third one was right on target, flying through the open part of the window and landing somewhere inside. He ducked in time to avoid the missile, and stayed down as the fourth one I threw put a spiderweb crack in the window's safety glass and clattered down the side of the truck to the ground. I had a fifth in my hand when he popped up, put the truck in gear, and barreled down Washington Street into the deepening fog, leaving Goatee with a backhoe's loader bucket high in the air and no place to put the ATM. I doubt if Goatee had even been aware of the bombardment up until that point. I made damn sure he was now. I heaved the brick in my hand toward him, trying to thread my way under the loader and between the roll cage posts to nail him in the driver's seat. My throw sailed high, hitting the bottom of the loader. The brick exploded into shrapnel-like fragments. One must have nicked him because I heard him curse loudly and then yell even louder, "You fucker!" While I reached for another brick, he punched the gas and pulled the backhoe around to head in the opposite direction down Washington. My next heave missed entirely, shattering on the pavement behind the back wheels. I trotted after him with my jacket load of bricks, but he was going too fast for me to keep up and throw at the same time. When he reached the intersection with Grant, he hung a sharp right. With the front loader raised high like pinchers and the back shovel and boom curled up like a tail, the backhoe in profile resembled an attacking scorpion. It also appeared unstable. The back wheels came off the ground during the turn, overbalanced by the weight of the ATM. It lunged out of view behind a building, and then I heard a hammering crash, a shrieking skidding noise, and the sound of glass breaking. I dropped the bricks and hustled the remaining 50 yards or so up to Grant. On the left side of the street, the backhoe had jumped the sidewalk and toppled into the plate glass window of a fancy art gallery. An alarm was ringing in the back of the building. Bits of glass were scattered over the sidewalk like wedding rice, and the ATM had rolled out of the loader bucket and come to rest beside a gigantic stone Buddha in the center of the store. I ran up to the backhoe to see if Goatee had been injured, but there wasn't a trace of him in the driver's cage. I found his hard hat in the middle of the road, picked it up, and then did a slow 360-degree revolution like Dumbo at the Ice Capades. Nada. He'd given me the slip. I was looking up to see if he had somehow flown away when I heard the wail of an approaching siren. The patrol car was on me in less than a minute, skidding to a stop on a diagonal across from the art gallery. I had already locked my hands together on top of my head, but the cops came out of the car with guns drawn, barking at me to lie down on the road. The one on the passenger side was a husky, corn-fed kid with a buzz cut who I didn't recognize. The driver was a fellow Irishman who I knew slightly from a bar on Clement Street called the Plow and Stars. I played a gig there one night, and he'd come up to introduce himself after the show. "McQuaid," I shouted as I dropped to my knees. "It's me, Reardon. I'm the one who called this in." He rose from his crouch behind the driver's door. He was a small man with a slender torso, and the body armor he wore made it seem like he was puffing out his chest. "I wondered if it was that, Reardon." He turned to his partner. "It's okay, Jerry. I know him." I stood and met them as they holstered their guns and walked to the front of the gallery. They looked over at the ATM, and then they looked down at the wreckage. McQuaid turned to me. "Freelancing for the reward?" "Yep." "Where's the perp?" "Hell if I know." I glanced over at Jerry, who was staring down at the backhoe, completely entranced. "John Deere," he said almost dreamily. "Now that's a tractor. My granddad swore by John Deere's on the farm. Said they used to call them Pumping Johnnies when he was growing up because of the funny pumping sound their engines made." I gave the kid what was probably a goggle-eyed look. This one sounded pretty normal to me. not that I was paying much attention. McQuaid smiled at his partner and explained, "Jerry's from Oklahoma, but what you might want to pay attention to is the owner of this building." "Oh, yeah?" I said. "Yeah, the bank may be very happy you saved their ATM, but I don't think that Lenora Lee will be pleased to find it in her front parlor, so to speak." "You don't mean..." Jerry laughed. "Oh, yes, he does. I'm from Oklahoma, and even I know who Lenora Lee is." He ran his hand lovingly over the shovel of the overturned backhoe. The Dragon Lady of Chinatown. Chapter 2. Enter the Dragon. The ringtone of my cell phone sounded annoyingly like the beep the backhoe made when backing up. I managed to retrieve the phone from my nightstand and lay it next to my ear without prying open my eyes. "Hello, Gretchen," I growled into the handset. "Good morning, August," said a playful voice. "How'd you know it was me?" "The jury's still out on this cell phone business. I haven't given the number to anybody else." "Well, let me be the first to welcome you to the 20th century. But in case you hadn't noticed, this is the 21st. Gretchen Sabatini was my secretary, confidant, Gal Friday, and one-time fiancé. She was also on a mission to cure me of my Luddite ways. As a private investigator, not having a cell phone had become more and more of a bother, and on a recent case had almost cost the life of a very good friend. Gretchen hadn't even waited for me to come to the obvious conclusion. She simply signed me up for the service one day and left the phone on my desk. "Thanks for the update on the time," I said, "but could you be a little more specific than the century?" "It's 11:20. "And you're waking me up after 4 hours of sleep because..." A fiendish giggle spilled out of the phone. "Because you're having tea with Lenora Lee at the Lee Family Association building at 1 p.m. "Tell her I'll take a rain check. I'm rotating my tires." "No can do. Her secretary was quite insistent. It might be a coincidence, but there's also a great picture of the Lee building on the front page of the Chronicle website this morning. The article suggests that a certain San Francisco PI had a hand in recent remodeling activities." I blinked open my eyes and rolled over to look at the ceiling. A dilapidated spiderweb clinging to the light fixture hovered and danced in the ambient breeze. I said, "Doesn't anyone read the paper on paper anymore?" "Online is better for breaking stories," said Gretchen. "Thank you for that. Well, I'll let you get gussied up for your meeting. Miss Lee's secretary emphasized that she expects the dress of visitors to be appropriate for a formal business occasion, and that she's a stickler on punctuality. And her lair, I mean her office, of course, is in the penthouse." I thanked Gretchen in a less than sincere fashion, and hung up to look in my closet for my confirmation suit. I lived on the top floor of a four-story building on the corner of Post and Hyde. Although it was late November, and Northern California had already gotten more than enough precipitation for the ski resorts in Tahoe to open early, it was an unusually clear and cold day, and I decided to walk the dozen or so blocks to Chinatown. I also decided the short pants that went with my confirmation suit weren't appropriate, so I settled on a charcoal three-button number that Gretchen had picked out for me when we were still seeing each other, and a wool and cashmere blend topcoat she bought for me to go with it. As long as we stayed above the ankles, I was looking pretty good, but my socks had holes, and my shoes were the same scuffed wingtips I always wore. I figured there was a limit to the sartorial splendor I was willing to expend for a meeting where I was going to get yelled at. I went down Post, past the newly designed Union Square with its vast, multicolored granite promenade that made people look like pieces on a chessboard, hung a left on Grant, and came up to the green-tiled gate that led into Chinatown. The streets around the square had been fairly thick with Christmas shoppers, but they were pikers compared to the dedicated ranks of souvenir-hunting tourists moving up and down Grant after I got through the gate. Wall-to-wall stores on both sides of the street were set up to cater to them. You could bag your limit cheaply in the shops that specialized in back-scratchers, paper parasols, skull caps with fake queues, and purses that looked like Chinese takeout boxes. But the bigger game was to be found in the places that sold antiques, artwork, jade and coral jewelry, and silk Qingsong dresses with slit skirts and mandarin collars. I elbowed my way along the sidewalk, and sometimes the gutter when I couldn't get by, up to the intersection with California, where the old St. Mary's Church stood. An inscription in large gold letters on the clock tower read, "Sun, observe the time and fly from evil," apparently intended for those who frequented the 19th century brothels across the street. It drove home the point that I was already 5 minutes late for my appointment with the Dragon Lady. I half walked, half jogged the rest of the way up the street to the Lee Family Association building. The backhoe was gone, broken glass from the window had been swept from the sidewalk, and plywood sheeting had been nailed in the window frame to cover the damage. A street musician sitting on a stool in the courtyard at the side of the building played a two-string Chinese violin, nodding and smiling at me as I double-checked the directory for Lenora Lee's office. She was in the penthouse, as Gretchen had said, but there were 11 other floors of Lee Family Enterprises on the way. These included the damaged gallery, offices for a Chinese-language newspaper, a real estate development firm, and just below the penthouse, a gourmet magazine-reviewed restaurant called the Jade Phoenix. I dropped a buck in the jar of the violin player and walked further back into the courtyard to a pair of elevators. After a little bit of trial and error, it became apparent that the closest one didn't go to the penthouse, and I needed to pick up a red phone on the wall next to the other to be let up. The phone rang for a long moment, and then I heard a woman say something like, "Li Hao." I figured that for hello, but that didn't buy me much. "Sorry," I said, "I don't speak Chinese." "No problem," said the same woman. "Is this Mr. Reardon?" "Yes. Is this Ms. Li?" She laughed pleasantly. "It is, but not the one you think. I'll open the elevator for you. Press the button marked P." I started to say thank you, but she had already hung up. I replaced the phone, waited for the elevator doors to clang open, and then took a quick ride to the top. The room I stepped into was walled in glass on two sides, affording spectacular views of North Beach, Telegraph Hill, the Financial District, and the Bay. But the view inside was even better. A paralyzingly beautiful Chinese woman waited for me by the elevator. She wore a red linen dress with black and white beading around the collar and a short matching jacket with the same beads around the cuffs and the outer edge. I expected it came from Paris or Milan, and I knew it didn't come cheap. Her hair fell to her shoulders and curled back in a soft lip that made me think of the 1960s, but looked swell anyway. Her face was angular with high cheekbones and was exquisite as all get out. Her figure, lithe and shapely. A scent of something light and floral emanated from her like a warm glow. She curled her lips into the tiniest of smiles, and I thought I'd been given the high sign for the rapture. "Mr. Reardon," she said. "That's the old me," I said. "I think I've been transported to a higher plane." Her eyebrows went up a fraction of an inch. "Really? Are you sure you just didn't get off on the wrong floor?" She must have seen something in my face, because she continued almost immediately. "Kidding. May I take your coat? It's cold outside, isn't it?" I peeled off the topcoat and passed it to her. "Sorry," I said. I guess I was already in enough trouble without adding to it. "And yes, it's cold. Which way to the execution?" She graced me with another of her tiny smiles. "It's nothing so bad as that. Lenora's in her office. Come with me." We went across an antique Chinese rug with a pagoda scene against a cobalt blue background and up to an office door that was flanked by matching 3-foot-high vases glazed in the same cobalt color. My escort knocked softly on the door and then pushed it open without waiting for a response. The room inside was dominated by a carved rosewood desk as big as Napoleon's tomb. Behind the desk sat a tiny woman in a tailored suit with jade jewelry at her ears, wrist, and neck. Her dark hair was pulled back in a cruel-looking bun that didn't get within shouting distance of flattering. It was hard to guess her age. She might have been a severe-looking 40 or a well-preserved 60. She rose as we entered and put her hand out across the desk for me to shake. I had to come right to the edge and lean far across to grasp it. "Mr. Reardon, I presume." She twitched her mouth open to display her front teeth in an expression that looked more like a baring of fangs than a smile, then said, "You're late." "Yes, I..." "Never mind. Please have a seat." The door pulled closed behind me, and I glanced over my shoulder like an idiot, and the weak hope that I hadn't been left alone with her. But of course I had. I sat down in a carved rosewood chair next to a matching table, with a Chinese tea service laid out. "Listen, Ms. Lee," I began, "about your window." My voice trailed off as I realized the dragon lady was still standing behind the desk, peering down at me. She looked me over carefully, and then after a moment sighed and returned to her high-backed chair. "You know how I judge a man? By his deeds? By his shoes." That was going to be my next guess. "A man who doesn't pay attention to his shoes doesn't pay attention to other details. He is lazy, and lazy men do not become prosperous." I looked down at my scuffed shoes and self-consciously positioned my feet under the chair. "Look, Ms. Lee."
"Mrs. Lee, please."
"Look, Mrs. Lee, I'm sorry about your window and all, but being a community-minded person, I would hope that you would appreciate the greater good I was trying to accomplish by catching the ATM thief. I'm betting your insurance will cover the expense, and if it doesn't, I suppose we could discuss damages, but I don't see the need for this dressing down. And, for your information, lazy men do not run around after backhoes at 2 a.m. Misguided ones, perhaps, but not lazy." She looked at me with eyes that were tinged with something, but damned if I could make it out. Amusement, perhaps.
"You misunderstand me, Mr. Reardon," was all she said. She gestured at the table beside me. "Would you pour the tea?"
I fumbled the delicate porcelain teapot around and managed to get the tea into the matching cups without breaking anything. I picked up the cup closest to her with the intention of passing it over, then hesitated, wondering if I was supposed to doctor it with something first. She was miles ahead of me.
"Chinese tea never contains sugar, milk, or lemon."
"Rightio." I stood and placed the cup on the desk in front of her. I hoped getting to the point was somewhere on the agenda, because character assassination and butler duties were getting to be a drag. I dropped back into my chair and picked up my tea to sample it. It was good. She sipped at hers, leaving a purpley red mark from her lipstick on the rim of the cup.
"I say you misunderstand me, because I'm not concerned about the window. If I chose to be concerned, it would be about the $8,000 ceramic bowl that was also destroyed."
I felt the heat rise to my cheeks. I hadn't considered that anything else in the store had been in harm's way.
"I didn't ask you here to discuss damages," she continued. "I ask you here to thank you. I am a community-minded person, and I am also a minority owner in the Bank of Canton and several other San Francisco financial institutions. I contributed to the reward fund, so I'm gratified that it motivated you to prevent the theft of our ATM.
She raised her cup in a little toast.
"So, thank you."
To say that I hadn't seen this one coming was putting it mildly. You're welcome, I managed. But I didn't actually catch the thief.
"No, not yet. We will be very pleased to pay the reward to you when you do."
"Okay." I shifted in my chair. I had the feeling there must be another size 6 pump ready to drop. Was there anything else? She hugged the cup to her chest with both hands as if to draw warmth.
"Yes, there was. You followed the recent city elections, of course."
Although I hadn't voted, it was hard to live in the city and not be aware of them. The mayoral contest had been the big ticket item, with 3 major candidates vying to take over for the outgoing incumbent, Charlie Hill. The favorite was Hill's hand-picked successor, Hunter Loudon. Young and handsome, Loudon was a political moderate. He was popular with business, particularly the tourist industry, because of his tough stand on the homeless problem, but he still retained Hill's affinity with labor, including the big unions in city government like the transit workers. To the right of Loudon was Alan Chow. He was a conservative businessman involved in retail. He had the support of the downtown business interests, including banking and real estate, and was popular in the predominantly Chinese neighborhoods of the city, like Chinatown, Sunset, Richmond, and Vistacon Valley. These had gone for Hill in previous elections, but were looking this time to put a candidate of their own in office. Lenora Lee was a big backer of Chow. Finally, there was Mike Padilla. Padilla was a firebrand lawyer from the Green Party who was interested in controlling development and improving the lot of the citizenry in San Francisco's poorer neighborhoods, like the Mission and Hunter's Point. His base was built in those neighborhoods, but he had other supporters throughout the more liberal districts, like the Haight and the Castro. The handicapping before the election had Loudon winning by a wide margin, Chow garnering a respectable tally, but less than what would be required to force a runoff, followed by Padilla with a single-digit percentage of the vote. The handicapping, it turned out, was pretty much wrong. Loudon and Padilla split the vote 45% to 40%, and Chow ended up in the single-digit zone. A runoff election was scheduled in early December for Loudon and Padilla to duke it out. I nodded at the woman across the desk. "Sure," I said. "I followed the elections. Your candidate lost." The Dragon Lady frowned.
"Don't be impertinent. Yes, Mr. Chow lost. And to be honest, I did not really expect him to defeat Loudon. But I was at least hoping you would force a runoff and perhaps encourage Loudon to include more of our thinking in his platform. Now I will be happy if we simply manage to defeat Padilla."
"I don't really have a dog in this fight, but it seems pretty obvious that you and the rest of Chow's supporters are going to go as a block to Loudon. Even those few percentage points should be enough to push him over the top."
"Not if the election is rigged."
I laughed. "Mrs. Lee, I felt like Alice down the rabbit hole ever since I walked in here. What could possibly make you think the election will be rigged? And what, if you don't mind my asking, does it have to do with me?"
"I'm afraid the runoff will be rigged, because I'm convinced the November election was. I want you to figure out who did it, how it was done, and prevent it from happening in December."
I blinked at her. "Do you want fries with that, too?"
"Please. It is not as fantastic as it sounds. As you probably know, the city installed touchscreen voting machines for this election. My computer experts tell me there are 100 ways to tamper with these machines, and very little in the way of audit controls to detect the tampering. I also have election experts who've done statistical analysis of historical voting patterns in the city, as well as racially motivated voting behavior. And what happened in the November election is completely inconsistent with past elections. A small example is that Padilla actually captured 34% of the vote in Chinatown. Impossible!"
I wasn't sure what to make of her comments about touchscreen voting, but I agreed with her assessment of Padilla's chances in this neighborhood. "Okay," I said cautiously, "but that still doesn't explain what you expect to accomplish by hiring me. Why not use your experts? Or better yet, have Chow protest the election and trigger a formal investigation. Isn't that the way election irregularities are supposed to be handled?"
"Chow is a weak-willed idiot."
"And I bet his shoes are scuffed, too." She slammed her teacup down on the desk, sloshing tea over the side.
"Mr. Reardon, I may have been wrong about you when I implied you were lazy, but I am developing some good ideas for new labels to apply. Please do me the courtesy of hearing me out without further injections of sarcasm. As I was about to say, Chow refuses to protest the election. He's afraid of being labeled a conspiracy theorist and hurting his chances in future campaigns."
"May I ask why you selected me, then? I mean, apart from the fact we ran into each other."
"I've done my research. I've talked to some of your former clients and contacts I have in law enforcement. I know you've successfully handled some high-profile cases involving technology. I'm offering you $1,000 a day until the election, which is less than a week from now, plus a bonus of $20,000 if you discover the person or persons behind the fraud."
My bank balance was so low it would fit under a lizard, so $1,000 a day was going to be hard to pass up. But despite my putative success with technology cases, I hardly felt qualified. "I appreciate the offer," I said, "but I know nothing about touchscreen technology. In fact, when it gets right down to it, I'm pretty much a technophobe. I wouldn't know where to begin with something like this."
"You begin with the appointment I set up for you this afternoon with Professor Ballou at Stanford University. He's a computer science and an expert on touchscreen voting fraud. He can provide all the expertise you need. In the end, this isn't really about technology. It's about investigative skills and the ability to get in someone's face until he or she gives you the information you want. Based on this interview, you seem like you'd do that well."
I thought about it for a moment. Assuming there was actually anything to be found, I still had zero conviction that I'd be able to uncover it. But I couldn't see walking away from the easy money. I also knew I could lean on my friend and sometime assistant, Chris Duckworth, to help me with the technology aspects.
All right, I said. I'm game. The dragon lady brought a hand up to the jade pendant around her neck. The stone was the size of a hockey puck. She rubbed the surface of the jade and produced another fang-bearing smile. Excellent. My daughter has a check for your retainer and the details of the appointment with Professor Baloo.
Your daughter?
The dragon lady actually laughed this time. Yes. Are you surprised? Her name is Lisa. She was Miss Chinatown last year.
When I was slow to respond, she came around the desk to escort me to the door. I rushed to return the teacup to the table and stood to walk with her.
Good luck, she said, and put her hand out to shake goodbye. I'd like regular reports. You can phone them in to Lisa, and I'll follow up if there's anything critical.
Roger that, I said before she hustled me out the door and back into the reception area. Lisa was sitting at a smaller rosewood desk off to one side. Music came from a stereo on the desk, and I recognized the tune as Things Ain't What They Used to Be from the Ellington Songbook. She looked up as I approached. Did you take the job? She made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Congratulations, then. I'm sure you'll do well. I came to a stop at the corner of the desk and stared down at her. It was hard to get over what a stunner she was. You and your mother are much more confident on that point than I am. I nodded at the stereo. You a jazz fan? Her face brightened. Yes, I am, as a matter of fact. Just the old stuff, though. My dad was a band leader and he got me hooked. He used to play in the restaurant downstairs.
Really? What instrument does he play?
He played drums. He called himself the Chinese Buddy Rich. She smiled at the memory and looked over my shoulder to the view of the bay, not really seeing it. He passed away some time ago. I'm sorry to hear that. An awkward moment went by. I caught her eye again and blurted, I'm playing jazz bass in a jazz quartet tomorrow night at Shanghai 1930. You should come and see me. She gave me a broad smile that nearly floated me out the Golden Gate. First with the higher plane stuff, she said, and now with the invitations. You're a fast mover, Mr. Reardon.
August.
All right, August. I'll think about it. In the meantime, you need to get a move on if you're going to make your appointment with Professor Baloo. She opened a drawer to extract a business envelope. This has a retainer check, directions to Dr. Baloo's office, and contact information for us.
Including your phone number?
Including my office phone number. She stood and snatched my coat from where it lay in a chair next to her desk. She passed the coat and the envelope over. Now I think you should go, she said, before you work yourself up to a marriage proposal. I bowed in what I hope was a chivalrous fashion. If marriage be premature, I said, perhaps a token of your esteem that I may be reminded of you on my quest. A kiss, for instance. She brought a hand to her mouth to suppress a laugh and looked around her desk. Her eyes settled on a pad of post-it notes. She peeled one off and stuck it to my lapel. There, good night. You shall bear my royal colors. I looked down at the droopy yellow square and shook my head. I wonder if this is how St. George got started. I made my retreat to the elevator, stepped inside, and then turned to look at her. You've got your cultures confused, she called out as the doors were closing. St. George slayed the dragon. You're on her payroll.
You have been listening to Runoff, a book hard-boiled great James Crumley described as a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Subscribe to hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.